had to collect and connect an incredible number of dots so he could bridge ideas from nature and mathematical concepts, forming connections others hadn't. To let his mind wander habitually, he played the violin for hours on end. Einstein worked to attain his genius. As he put it, quote, "I have no special talents. I am only passionately curious," end quote. Asking questions like, what would it be like to race alongside a light beam? He spun complex webs of dots to formulate his theory of relativity. Despite his accomplishments, even Einstein was afflicted by imposter syndrome. Once telling his wife Elsa, while listening to cheers of 1,000 people outside his hotel room, quote, "I'm afraid we're swindlers. We'll end up in prison yet," end quote. There are countless examples of others who let their minds wander to connect ideas. To write Hamilton, arguably the best Broadway show ever created, composer Lin-Manuel Miranda would make musical loops in a computer program and then walk around in scatter focus mode until the lyrics came to him. While we often find the story of a lone, driven genius compelling, all geniuses have put in time and effort to achieve greatness. That includes Mozart, who wrote his first symphony at the age of 8. Daniel Levitin, the author of This Is Your Brain on Music, proposed a theory to account for Mozart's musical genius. As he put it in his book, quote, "We don't know how much Mozart practiced, but if he started at age 2 and worked 32 hours a week, quite possible given his father's reputation as a stern taskmaster, he would have made his first 10,000 hours by the age of 8, end quote. The 10,000-hour rule is a popular one. It's the length of effortful practice, some suggest, that it takes to acquire an expert level of performance at a certain skill. While the rule doesn't apply in every case, you could probably become a world-class master chocolate bar eater in less time, it's a fairly reliable yardstick. 10,000 hours is enough time to build a rich constellation of dots around a certain topic or skill. Making scatter focus a habit. I hope that by now, I've sold you on the remarkable benefits of scatter focus mode. Scatter focus lets you find useful connections between disparate ideas and experiences, recharge, and plan for the future. To reap these benefits, you simply have to let your mind rest and wander, preferably while doing something habitual. How frequently you should scatter your attention will depend on a host of factors. For one, it will be tied to how often you use and need to recharge your ability to hyperfocus. Hyperfocus consumes mental energy, while scatter focus is energy restorative. Scattering your attention will be particularly beneficial when your work demands that you connect more complex, disparate ideas. For example, you should scatter your attention more often if you're a researcher responsible for designing experiments or a video game designer who constructs storylines. The more creativity your job requires, the more often you should scatter your attention. In most cases, the knowledge work of today benefits from as much creativity as we can bring to it. Finally, the frequency with which you scatter your attention should reflect how important it is that you find the right approach to your work. Another of my favorite quotes is from Abraham Lincoln, who said, quote, "Give me 6 hours to chop down a tree, and I will spend the first 4 sharpening the axe," end quote. Whether we're planning a home renovation project, allocating our team's budget, or designing a research study, the approach we take to the task at hand matters. The more scatter focus time we schedule as we're putting together a plan, the more time we'll save later. The brain needs a few minutes to switch between hyperfocus and scatter focus. Therefore, taking scatter focus breaks that are at least 15 minutes long will yield better results than trying to take advantage of tiny chunks of time throughout the day. But even brief breaks will help you become more creative, for while they may not leave sufficient time to piece together complex eureka insights, they'll definitely enable you to set intentions for what to do next, rest, and capture the open loops at the top of your mind. All three flavors of scatter focus. habitual, capture, and problem-solving work in both small and large periods of time, though they'll provide you with more benefits at longer durations. As well as entering scatter focus mode on work breaks, there are countless other opportunities to apply scatter focus during the day. Disconnect from the internet between 8 p.m. and 8 a.m. Notice when you finish a task and use that as a cue to scatter your attention for a bit. Buy a cheap alarm clock so you're not immediately distracted by your phone when you wake up. Walk to get a coffee, carrying only a notepad. As a challenge to yourself, leave your phone at home for an entire day. Take an extra long shower. Make yourself bored for 5 minutes and notice what thoughts run through your head. Tame distractions and simplify your environment to make sure your attention doesn't overflow the next time you do a creative hobby. Cook with music playing instead of watching something entertaining. Go for a nature walk. Visit an art gallery. Work out without music or a podcast. Objectively speaking, scatter focus might seem fairly unproductive. You're on a bus, staring out the window. You're walking through nature or jogging without headphones. You're in a waiting room, writing in a notepad instead of tapping on your phone. Though you don't look busy, your mind certainly is. Scatter focus is the most creative mode of your brain. Just as with hyperfocus, it's worth spending as much time as you possibly can practicing it. Chapter 10. Working Together. Blending hyperfocus and scatter focus. In many ways, hyperfocus and scatter focus are complete opposites. At any given moment, we're either doing something with external attention or thinking about something with internal attention. We're unable to be in both hyperfocus mode and scatter focus mode at the same time. For all of the ways they differ, though, there are a lot of useful opportunities to use the two modes to work together. When we focus, we consume and collect dots. When we scatter our attention, we connect those dots. Hyperfocus allows us to remember more, which leads to more valuable connections made in scatter focus mode. Scatter focus lets us recharge, which in turn provides more energy to hyperfocus. The insights we unearth in scatter focus help us work smarter later. In these ways and others, deliberately managing our attention is a practice with compounding benefits. There are several strategies you can deploy that let you take greater advantage of both hyperfocus and scatter focus. These strategies will help regardless of which mode you happen to be in. Invest in your happiness. If you wade through the many books, articles, and other works of research on the subject of happiness, you're likely to become depressed only by the sheer amount of advice that exists. Some of it is useful, but a lot of empty promises are also made. It's important to make a distinction between legitimately investing in happiness and merely thinking more positively. To put it bluntly, positive thinking does not work to make you more happy or productive. In fact, research has shown it's counterproductive. In one study, the more an overweight woman fantasized about being skinny, the less weight she lost over a year. In another, the more post-surgery patients fantasized about their recovery, the slower the improvement in their condition. In other studies, fantasizing positively about the future made participants perform worse on tests, decreased people's odds of entering new romantic relationships, promoted a lower mastery of everyday life, and even led people to contribute less to charity. Positive thinking lets us feel successful in the moment, but at the price of making an actual plan to become successful later. In practice, there's little difference between positive thinking and wishful thinking. What does work to increase our level of happiness? spending time on things that boost our level of positive affect, how good we feel. There is a wealth of actual research demonstrating that becoming happier helps us manage our attention, as well as suggesting proven ways to boost our level of happiness. Curiously, the more we invest in our happiness, the more productive we become in hyperfocus mode, and the more creative we become in scatterfocus mode. Before getting into why, it's worth noting that you're likely to find yourself feeling happier simply by practicing the ideas in this book. You're significantly less content when your mind wanders against your will, even when it's wandering to neutral topics. You're about as happy when your mind is unintentionally wandering to a positive topic as you are when focusing on something mundane. Practicing hyperfocus and working with fewer distractions helps focus more intention on the present. Intentionally letting your mind wander takes the guilt, doubt, and stress out of the process because you choose to unwind rather than doing so against your will. Generally speaking, a wandering mind makes us less happy unless we're thinking about something we're interested in, something useful, or something novel. Scatterfocus, the intentional form of mind wandering, lets us experience all three. Why exactly does investing in happiness foster productivity and creativity? First, and most important, a positive mood expands the size of your attentional space, regardless of which mode you're in. When you're happy, the amount of dopamine in the logical part of your brain rises, which leads you to approach your work with more energy and vigor. And because you have more attentional space to work with, you have the resources you need to focus more deeply and accomplish more. Being in a good mood also makes you better at recalling information on the fly. You also consume information more actively. The happier you are, the more likely you are to put ideas together in new and interesting ways, and the better you're able to overcome functional fixedness and, like MacGyver, see new uses for familiar things. Happiness also encourages you to seek more variety, but not the risky kind. On the other hand, a negative mood shrinks the size of your attentional space. Unhappy people are less productive, full stop. The less happy you are, the more often your mind wanders against your will, and the less attention you bring to what's in front of you. The less happy you feel, the more important it is to tame distractions, as you have less attentional space and energy to resist them. The places where your mind wanders are also different when you're feeling negative. You're more likely to make your way to the distant past, ruminating on events that took place then. As a footnote, the way researchers measured this in a lab was by having participants listen to either happy or mournful music while saying either positive or negative statements. Some participants heard uplifting music like Mozart's Eine kleine Nachtmusik, while uttering statements like, I have complete confidence in myself. Others listened to sadder music like Barber's Adagio for Strings, while uttering statements like, just when I think things are going to get better, something else goes wrong. While you can sometimes benefit from reliving past experiences, in the short run, your productivity suffers. When your mind wanders more to the past, you plan for the future less often and assemble fewer productive ideas. And at the same time that your unwanted mind-wandering episodes increase, they become less pleasant and productive. This is why it's so important to capture the problems you're tackling when you're in a negative mood. Whenever you're feeling miserable, you're often also dealing with a number of serious issues. The Zeigarnik effect, which keeps unresolved problems front of mind, forces you to think of them more. People who are unhappy also take longer to refocus after an interruption and dwell more often on their failures. According to one study, habits that train our brain to wander less, such as mindfulness and meditation, are even, quote, effective in reducing relapse in recovering depressive individuals, end quote. While there is little research on exactly to what degree your attentional space expands when you're happy, Happiness expert and Harvard-trained psychologist Sean Acor found that happier people are 31% more productive than those in a negative or neutral state. Happiness also helps you become more creative in scatter-focus mode. You're more likely to experience insightful solutions to problems when you're in a positive frame of mind, which is not surprising, given that your brain has more attentional space and energy with which to work. How, then, can we invest in our happiness using the findings of science? One of my favorite studies, the same one that discovered that we spend 47% of our time daydreaming, sampled thousands of participants throughout the day, asking two questions. What were the subjects doing at the instant they were sampled? Participants received a notification on their phones. And how happy did they feel doing that thing? At the time of the study's publication, the researchers had received more than 250,000 responses from thousands of subjects. Here are the top five activities that made them the happiest. 5. Listening to music. 4. Playing. 3. Talking and investing in their relationships. 2. Exercising. And 1. Making love. It's worth noting that our minds wander the least when we're making love, and that we're significantly happier doing so than we are doing anything else. Nothing else comes close. To really invest in your attention, try doing all five of these things at once. As well as these activities, there are a number of other habits that have been proven to make people happier. One of my favorite researchers in the happiness field is the aforementioned Sean Acor, the author of The Happiness Advantage. In the book, and in his TED Talk, Sean offers a few science-backed strategies to bolster your happiness. A few of his top suggestions? Recalling three things you're grateful for at the end of each day, a good companion tactic to the rule of three discussed in Chapter 3. Journaling at the end of each day about one good experience you had. Meditating. And performing a random act of kindness. While moods and attitudes aren't necessarily dots and ideas you can focus on and remember, they do greatly influence how you perceive and relate to what's in your attentional space, and they affect the size of your attentional space itself. Happiness is the rose-colored lens we place atop our attentional space, which allows us to relate to our experiences in a more productive and creative fashion. If you need a boost, pick a few items from each of these lists to try. Reflect on the difference they make for you. Try all 9 ideas and keep what works. At the end of the day, these strategies won't only make you happier. They'll also make you more productive and creative. Work around your energy levels. As you've probably experienced, energy levels over the course of the day are anything but constant. They fluctuate according to when your body is programmed to have the most energy. For example, if you happen to be an early bird or a night owl, how often you exercise, what you eat, and whether you get enough sleep. Like energy levels, your focus and productivity aren't consistent either. You're the most productive when you dedicate your energy-rich moments to your most complex, meaningful tasks. If you've read or listened to my previous book, The Productivity Project, you're already familiar with this idea. Hyperfocus is most effective during your peak energy times. I call these your biological prime time, BPT for short, and the precise times of day will differ for everyone. By charting your energy levels for a week or two, you're able to identify your own patterns. The more productive tasks you do during your BPT, the more productive you become. There is a flip side to this concept when it comes to scatter focus. Scatter focus is most powerful when you have the least energy. Your brain is less inhibited during these periods and doesn't hold back the ideas it generates. Analytic problems require focused attention to solve. But solutions to creative problems come when you connect the greatest number of ideas. One study discovered we solve 27.3% more insight problems during our non-optimal time of day, when we're naturally more tired. I call these time periods when we have the least energy our creative prime time. There's no shortage of research examining when we naturally have the most energy. For most people, this occurs during the late morning, around 11 a.m., and mid-afternoon, around 2 or 3 p.m. Our energy is typically lowest right after lunch. Energy levels also fluctuate throughout the week. We're typically least engaged with our work on Mondays when we experience the most boredom, and are the most engaged on Fridays. A footnote on this, another random fun finding from this study, we do the greatest number of rote tasks on Thursdays, about a third of the routine tasks we do throughout the entire week. If you fall into this pattern, it might be worth seeing your Thursdays as your maintenance day, when you do all the tasks you'd rather not focus on during the rest of the week. Everyone is different, of course. If you're an early bird who springs out of bed at 5 a.m., your prime time might fall earlier in the day, and afternoons might be the best time for creative work. Similarly, night owls may find they're most productive when others have long since gone to bed. A great way to work smarter is to schedule tasks that require focused attention during your BPT and tasks that require more creativity during your CPT. Block time for these tasks in your calendar. Drink alcohol and caffeine strategically. As far as decreasing your inhibitions is concerned, you're probably familiar with the effects of alcohol. Much like being tired, drinking has been shown to make people better at solving creative problems. To test this theory, I rewrote some of this chapter while sipping vodka sodas with a lime twist. I'll let you be the judge of whether it's any better than the others. A favorite study I encountered in writing this book was one that had participants get mildly intoxicated while watching the Disney Pixar movie Ratatouille. The researchers split participants into two groups. One group was fed a bagel, as well as multiple vodka cranberry drinks, both in quantities relative to how much each participant weighed. The subjects consumed the drinks while watching the film. The second, significantly less lucky group, also watched the movie, but didn't consume any food or drinks in the process. The study's findings were remarkable. After watching the movie, tipsy participants solved 38% more creative word puzzles than the sober participants. Not only that, they solved the problems more quickly. As you might have guessed, the drunk participants weren't better at solving logical problems. Again, when it comes to solving creative problems, the less control we have over our attention, the better. This is not intended to advocate the use of alcohol, which is, of course, not without its downsides. The Ratatouille study measured performance on tasks that required pure creativity, but most tasks require a mix of creativity and focus. When it comes time to focus on something, alcohol will absolutely obliterate your productivity. If you're into meditation, experiment with having a drink or two before your next evening session. You'll experience this effect firsthand. Consuming alcohol makes your mind wander more often, while at the same time decreasing your meta-awareness. Alcohol affects two aspects of the quality of your attention. Not only will you focus for a shorter period of time, but also it will take you longer to realize that your mind has wandered. Being under the influence also diminishes the size of your attentional space and makes it more difficult to focus on pretty much anything. The more you drink, the more your mind wanders, the less awareness you have to halt it, and the smaller your attentional space becomes. It's no wonder we remember less when we've had a few drinks. It's impossible to remember what we don't pay attention to in the first place. In practice, alcohol is worth consuming only for very select tasks. If it's the end of the day and you want to brainstorm, sipping a wobbly pop will help. But keep in mind that it helps precisely because it decreases how much control you have over your attention. I view drinking alcohol as a way by which we borrow energy and happiness from the following day. Sometimes this price is worth paying, such as when you're hanging out with friends you haven't seen in a while, but often it simply isn't. If you drink alcohol, do so strategically. In those rare times when you want to let your mind roam more freely and have nothing important planned afterward, or you want to steal some happiness from tomorrow. Caffeine is another drug to consider consuming strategically. When it comes to managing attention, caffeine has the polar opposite effect of alcohol. While alcohol helps us scatter focus, caffeine helps us hyperfocus. The research is conclusive. Caffeine boosts mental and physical performance in pretty much every measurable way. It deepens our focus, regardless of whether a task is simple or complex, and narrows it, which makes hyperfocusing on a task easier, but scatter focus more difficult. It helps us persevere, especially with tasks that are long and tedious. It boosts our determination, regardless of how tired or fatigued we are. It improves our performance on tasks that require verbal memory, a quick reaction time, or visuospatial reasoning. For example, putting together a jigsaw puzzle. In general, these effects diminish after the consumption of approximately 200 milligrams of caffeine. A single cup of coffee contains around 125 milligrams. Amounts greater than 400 milligrams should be avoided, as at that amount, you begin to feel more anxious and your performance becomes impaired. Again, take this advice only if you find it holds true for you. We all react differently to caffeine. Some metabolize it quickly and have a high tolerance, and others find their entire body vibrating after just a few sips. As with most productivity advice, implementing individual tactics with an awareness of how well they actually work for you is key. Caffeine can also boost your performance on physical work and exercise. It helps you perform in hot conditions, boosts strength training performance, and increases your tolerance for pain during exercise. Just like alcohol, caffeine is not without its drawbacks. Even when you consume healthier caffeinated drinks that aren't loaded with sugar, like black tea, green tea, or matcha, my personal favorite. As your body metabolizes caffeine out of your system, your energy crashes and your productivity dips. Caffeine can also disrupt your sleep, which can make you less productive the next day. Because of these costs, choose caffeine when you'll actually benefit from the mental or physical performance boost. Provided it's not too late in the day, consume a bit of caffeine the next time you're about to hyperfocus on a task or hit the gym for a big workout. If you're looking for a near instantaneous boost, try caffeinated gum. Your body absorbs caffeine most quickly through the buccal tissue in your mouth. Instead of having a cup of coffee after you awake, wait until you get to work so you'll benefit from the boost when you work on your most productive tasks. If you have a brainstorming meeting first thing in the morning, consume caffeine after the session, keeping the walls of your attentional space low to let more ideas flow. If you have a pitch meeting, on the other hand, do the opposite. Open offices. I give productivity talks in many different workplaces, and over time, I've noticed more companies adopting an open office plan. Open offices are a mixed bag when it comes to focus and productivity. It's easiest to focus when we work in an environment we can control. And obviously we have less control over our environment and therefore our attention in an open office. Research supports this. We distract ourselves 64% more often in an open environment, and we're interrupted by others more as well. An open office can seriously undermine your productivity if you do a lot of work that requires focused attention. Open offices do have their benefits. One is that they support working for longer on a single project before switching to another. The reason for this is interesting. While our colleagues interrupt us more in an open environment, they're also more considerate about when they do. Because they can observe us working, they notice when we've reached a natural breakpoint in our work. When we return to our desk after a meeting, at the end of a phone call, or when we stand up after completing something. In these environments, we're interrupted more often when we're switching between tasks, so we don't need as much time and energy to refocus. While this book focuses on personal productivity, our work doesn't exist in a vacuum. The projects on our plates are typically intertwined with the work of others. In highly collaborative work, the faster we can get information from others and the more quickly they can get information from us, the better the collaboration, as the team will become more productive as a whole system. The bottom line when it comes to open office plans is that if the work you and your team does is hyper-collaborative or involves a great deal of creativity and connecting ideas, an open office is probably worth its disadvantages. If your work involves a significant number of tasks that benefit from undisturbed focus, as more and more jobs seem to, an open office can be detrimental to your productivity. If you're a manager, consider the type of work your team does before you plan for an open office. If you do decide this design is worth the potential productivity costs, be sure to educate your employees on how to manage interruptions. One study found that after a team understood how costly interruptions were, they fell by 30%. It's also worth investigating whether most of the interruptions you or your team face come from a common source. For example, if you lead a group of programmers who are interrupted mostly for feature requests and questions about the product, create a tool for those outside your team to suggest new features and produce more useful documentation so the interruptions that do come in are less frequent and less costly. If you can't avoid adopting an open office plan, be sure to designate a quiet zone where employees can hyperfocus without interruption. Creating a focus ritual. By now, we've covered how to integrate both hyperfocus and scatter focus into your life and make a habit out of entering each mode daily. Enter hyperfocus mode at least once a day to deal with your most productive tasks. Eliminate distractions and concentrate on one important thing. Enter scatter focus multiple times a day, particularly habitual scatter focus mode, so that you can plan for the future, connect ideas, and recharge your ability to hyperfocus. Do the same at home, hyperfocusing on meaningful experiences and conversations, and scatter focusing when you need to plan, rest, or ideate. Some weeks, you may find that you need more of one than the other. One of my favorite weekly rituals is a focus ritual, which I schedule for every Sunday evening or Monday morning to plan my week. During it, I decide on my 3 weekly intentions and assess how much I'll need to hyperfocus and scatter focus in the days ahead. I'd be lying if I said I spent a lot of time planning how long I'll dedicate to each mode. No one should do that. But I do consider, briefly, whether my week will benefit from one mode more than the other. When doing the same for your own schedule, ask yourself questions like these. How much productivity and creativity will I need this week? Does an upcoming deadline mean I need to hyperfocus more than usual, or do I have more space to plan for the future and connect ideas? What commitments do I have coming up that will get in the way of my hyperfocus and scatterfocus time? For example, travel, a draining conference, or an inordinate number of meetings. How can I deal with these obstacles in advance? How many blocks of time can I commit to hyperfocus and scatterfocus? Can I commit to these periods in my calendar? Noticing. This final chapter has explored a variety of ideas that will enable you to take even greater advantage of your attention. By investing in your happiness, working around your energy levels, drinking alcohol and caffeine strategically, considering your office environment, And taking into account both hyperfocus and scatterfocus as you plan your week, you'll be able to take deliberate management of your attention to the next level. It's also important not to lose sight of one final concept that's paramount to managing your attention well: awareness. As you become more aware of what's occupying your attentional space, how much energy you have, and how full your attentional space is, you'll become more agile and adjust as conditions change. For example, if you've reached an impasse with a problem, awareness will give you the ability to determine whether the problem is more analytical or requires creative insight to solve. You can then enter hyperfocus or scatterfocus accordingly. One of the best strategies to train your brain to become more aware is the hourly awareness chime I discussed in Chapter 3. When the chime dings, reflect on what's occupying your attentional space as well as the state of your attention. Odds are you haven't experimented with every idea in this book, but if you haven't already, do try this one. In addition to an hourly awareness chime, try picking a few cues you encounter each day, at work and at home, to use as reminders to check your attentional space. Awareness is the thread that winds its way through most of the tactics in this audiobook. When you're aware of what has taken hold of your attention, you're able to draw it back toward more important and meaningful things. You'll then work with greater purpose, focus for longer, and daydream less, all of which will increase the quality of your attention and the quality of your life. Awareness is really just a process of noticing things, and there is a lot to notice. I hope you've discovered some of the curious ways your own attention works. Maybe you've noticed the quality of your attention, how much of your time you spend intentionally, the duration of your focus, and how long your mind wanders before you catch it doing so. Maybe you've noticed just how often you automatically pay attention to anything that's novel, pleasurable, or threatening. Maybe you've noticed how quickly objects of attention pass through your attentional space. Above all, I hope you've become more productive, creative, and purpose-driven. The power of managing your attention well. The benefits of effectively managing your attention are innumerable. For starters, you'll feel more in control as you turn off autopilot mode and manage your attention deliberately. You'll begin to understand its limits and become better able to work within them, learning when you can and can't multitask. Your life becomes more meaningful because you pay greater attention to meaningful experiences and process them more deeply. In this way, meaning isn't something we try to find, it's something we make an effort to notice. You get more done because you're actually able to focus on important matters. You're able to think more clearly and become more engaged with your work. You plan for the future and set intentions more frequently. You feel better rested and less guilty about taking a step back. And you connect more ideas while amassing constellations of them in your mind about topics that drive your curiosity further. This inspires you to become more creative, lets you work smarter and more intuitively, and makes you more productive on creative projects. Hyperfocus can help you get an extraordinary amount done in a relatively short period of time. Scatterfocus lets you connect ideas, which helps you unearth hidden insights, become more creative, plan for the future, and rest. Together, they will enable you to work and live with purpose. Your attention is the most powerful tool at your disposal to live and work with greater productivity, creativity, and purpose. Managing it well will enable you to spend more time and energy on your most purposeful tasks and to work more often with intention, focus for longer periods, and stumble into fewer unwanted daydreams. I hope you spend it wisely. This is Chris Bailey. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Hyperfocus: How to Be More Productive in a World of Distraction. This program was directed by Robert Kessler. Executive producer, Juliana Wilson. Text copyright 2018 by Chris Bailey. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.